Send your wildlife recordings, questions and observations on WhatsApp to 087 708 7031.
And a very busy programme ahead of us today. Don't forget, you can email mooney@rte.ie or you can send a text message right now about anything at all to 51551. A very busy show ahead of us today. We've got an even bigger programme, if that's possible, tomorrow evening right here on RT Radio 1. We're going to be celebrating the summer solstice and we're hoping to be live with Aina Nilauna in Kilrush Quay in County Clare, where she is today, I believe. Aina, how are you?
Hello, Derek. Yes, I am here in Kilrush today as well, and I will be here again tomorrow too, when it is the actual solstice, the longest day of the year, the longest time between sunrise and sunset. And of course, the beauty of me being down in Kilrush, you will understand, among many other beauties, is that the sunset is later by about 20 minutes than it is on the east coast. So the sun will go down on air, Derek, tomorrow night when we open our programme at 10 o'clock, because sunset tomorrow night in Kilrush will be at 10:05, so we'll be just beginning our programme as the sun goes into the Atlantic Ocean with a great sizzle.
Ooh,
as it goes into the water.
It sounds delicious. We'll have the company of Paddy Glacken and Donal Lunny, two of Ireland's greatest traditional musicians, with us tomorrow. They'll be playing a tune for us before the end of the show today. Richard Collins will be in Malahide. Hi, Richard, how are you today?
Hello, Derek. I'm glad that you're doing it in the evening, because the dawn now is exceedingly early and I wouldn't like to have to get up and be entertaining at that hour of the morning.
When are you usually entertained? No, don't answer that question, Richard. Anyway, let's. Niall Hatch is with me in studio. Niall, you're going to be out at midday for us tomorrow. Where will you be?
I will, at the exact midpoint of the day of the solstice, I will be at Birdwatch Ireland's East Coast Nature Reserve in Newcastle and in County Wicklow. It's the time of year when birds start to wind down their singing. So I want to hear some of that last songs of the season. The solstice sort of marks the period when the song goes into decline, the birds start to switch more into molting and then migration mode. So looking forward to that.
And we'll be talking to some of our friends in other parts of Ireland, the Inishowen Peninsula, on Rockabill. I know John McKenna is the man who's getting up very early in the morning, indeed, as Pat Mustard would say, and he's going to be down near Mount Leinster in County Carlow on our behalf. And then we'll be going to the land of the midnight sun. We'll be going to a fjord in Norway outside of Tromso on a midnight sun safari. In fact, one of the places in the world where you can see sunset and sunrise at the same time. It's going to be a fascinating programme. Really looking forward to it. But right now, let's say hello to Terry Flanagan, our man with his eye on nature, out and about somewhere. Terry, where are you today?
Well, Derek, I can tell you that for this week, I'm on terra firma, because the last couple of weeks I've been on the canals around the city and I've been on the River Dodder. Today, I'm at Constitution Hill. Constitution Hill links the Keys with Phibsborough, and I'm just inside the south gate of the King's Inns. Now, the King's Inns is a law school, and it's very well known here in the city. It was designed by Gandon, no less. The building started, I think, around 1800. Took about 15 or 20 years for it to be completed. But it's not this magnificent building I've come to see. No, not at all. You're familiar with carnivorous plants, aren't you?
Yes, indeed.
The Venus flytrap and the sundews and the way they eat the likes of the insects, but they're all very, very small. Well, I'm actually sitting on a bench here that's slowly been eaten by a plant. I suppose you could call it nature's revenge. And some call it the world's largest carnivorous plant. Mm-hmm. Well, in fact, it's a tree and it's more than 20 metres high and it's 80 to 100 years old. It's a London plane and there were wide planted here in Dublin and in London around the 19th century. But this tree is special. This tree has even got its own name. It's called the Hungry Tree. And for years now, it's been consuming this cast iron bench that I'm sitting on. The Hungry Tree has even been listed as a heritage tree by the Tree Council of Ireland. Now, how many trees can you think of that have been given their own name? Well, if I think of the first one I can think of would be the Big Tree, which is down there on Dorset Street and on North Circular Road. It's not even a tree at all.
It was a pub.
Exactly. But the reason I think it was called the Big Tree was because of a large London plane tree that was outside it. Mm. I know there are a number of trees, the likes of the Sitting Tree in Glendalough, that's down near you, I think, Niall. There's the Money Tree in County Leash and the King Oak Tree in Tullamore, which we featured many times on the programme. And if people don't believe me, have a look at the website, because I've sent in a photo of yours truly sitting on the seat here. Now, the tree itself, it's a hybrid, it's a plane. A lot of people think they're called sycamores. They're not sycamores. sycamores. It's a hybrid is when two different species crossbreed. One of them was an Oriental plane, the other was an American plane, and it was first discovered in London. Although it was thought to have hybridized in Spain, there was a gardener there many years ago. I think he was Charles the First gardener, a guy called John Tradescant, and I think what he was doing is he was growing some of these trees very, very close together, and they managed to fertilize each other. Now, why are they being planted in the cities? Because they're all over the city. I think London, for instance, has more than 50% of all of the trees that are in London are London planes. Well, they do provide lots of beauty and lots of shade. In fact, on my road where I lived as a child, off the North Circular Road, there was a London plane directly outside the door. It was absolutely beautiful. They can withstand poor soil. And if you look at them around the city too, you'll notice that there's no soil around them. It's just that the cement or the tar comes right up to them. They can withstand a lot of drought and wind, and they can absorb pollutants. Now, I want you to talk a little bit about that, because a lot of them were planted in and around London around the 1840s or so, and that was the time of the Industrial Revolution. And they don't actually absorb pollutants. That's what a lot of people think they do. But what happens is the bark of this tree, anyone who knows this tree will know that the bark peels off. And what happens is that these pollutants, they stick onto the bark and they stick onto the hairs on the leaves. But there's a problem. It's something I've read recently, and I want to ask Richard about this too, is that I'm told that these trees, they emit a compound called isoprene. Now, all trees, I'm told, or the majority of trees do, but the planes, they produce or release quite a lot of it. And this isoprene, it combines with nitrous oxide and it forms ozone. So is it true, Richard, do you know? And why is this ozone dangerous? Because we're all told that ozone is good for us.
Terry, do you know who comes to mind when you ask that question? One Ronald Reagan. Because back in the 1980s, Ronald Reagan made a statement that trees produce more pollution than cars. He was, of course, against clamping down on pollution, you see, to somebody being of that persuasion. But in a funny, twisted kind of way, he was right, because trees produce vast quantities of this substance. Isoprene is one of many things they produce, and it is used as a way of protecting the tree if conditions are very warm. It's an antioxidant, and it does produce vast quantities of it. Apparently, the amount of isoprene produced by plants equals the amount of methane produced by animals, which is an extraordinary thing. So he's quite right, but he's not right in thinking that the net effect of all this release is worse than cars. The cars are far worse, because the oxides they produce are lethal. They cause the smog, and they cause all the breathing disorders and everything else. The three oxides of nitrogen and isoprene is a help in reducing those. So he wasn't right, but he was onto something, shall we say. It produces ozone. Now, ozone is a toxic substance. It is. It's a nasty substance. It's heavier than air. Now, if the temperature is very high, the isoprene will reduce nitrous oxide, particularly to ozone, and the ozone will collect on the ground. But only in very high temperatures does it get to a stage where it would be offensive to people. I think that's true.
Yes, it is true, Richard. It has to go way up in the 20s, like 25, 26. Now, which it may probably attain in London, but we would be a very warm day in Ireland if we had much of that. What happens with the bark of the tree, Terry, is that apparently, this is interesting, that the bark is on the tree, grand, and it's getting covered in grime and soot, grand, and on normal trees, that this soot on the bark of a tree would block the lenticels, the kind of little pores that are on the living part underneath. But as the bark can't grow as fast as the trunk of the tree grows, actually faster than the bark in places cracks and sloughs off and comes off in lumps and pieces. So you have this camouflaged sort of effect where bits of bark on, bits of it there, and some going this year and some going next year, and taking the grime with it when it does, and exposing these lenticels underneath, and they're all nice and clean again. And this is where your isoprene can come out, and it only then will become nasty, if you like, or adding to the nitrous oxides, if the nitrous oxides are actually there from cars and from pollution, because cities are terrible places for pollution. But it's interesting because in London in those times when the London plane was actually given that name, because more than half of the trees of London are these planes, the pollution in London at that time was soot. It was soot from the chimneys of burning coal. They burned coal for the Industrial Revolution. They burned coal in order to smelt iron and to make steel and all of these things, and the soot in the air was what caused it. And in fact, if you look at Dublin, you're up there now in Constitution Hill, and that's an older part of Dublin, and if you look around, the amount of chimney pots on the houses, particularly down to the quays and around the Liffey there, loads and loads and loads of chimney pots, and every single room in those 4 and 5 storey houses had fireplaces in them. They had fireplaces in the hall. There was a special type of wallpaper on the stairs which could be washed on the lower half of the stairs, so when the maids were carrying, the poor maids was always women, wasn't it, who carried the buckets of coal up to all those bedrooms to light the fires, that the wallpaper could be washed and then kept clean. So Dublin was equally horrible and smutty and full of soot from those that coal burning as well, right up indeed until the 1980s, if you like. I mean, in the 1980s what happened was that the city council monitored the amount of dirt in the atmosphere, and they used to produce all the results every April and tell us what the levels of this was in the city the previous winter. So you knew in April what you died of at Christmas time. You knew in April what the levels of soot and the levels of pollution in the city were. And Gay Byrne, who had his Gay Byrne show, Gay, who changed the nation with his radio programme, he did change the nation here because he maintained that this was rubbish. I mean, here they were producing these results next April when it was no good. And he, by bringing this to his attention, the attention of everybody every day, shamed, I suppose, Dublin City Council into producing their results day by day by day. We had EU levels then. We had the Maastricht Convention, which brought in the Habitats Directive and brought in this whole business of air quality. And we had levels of air quality that we weren't to go past. And Gay would every morning read out how much pollution there was. And there was a famous year in the late 1980s where we had an inversion one Christmas, just after Christmas in January. The cold air sat like a lid over Dublin, which was a low-down city, a layer of cold air, and the smoke couldn't get out, and the sky, I remember, turned yellow, and the smoke turned yellow, and the air turned yellow, and the levels of pollution at that time were absolutely terrible. So it was Gay who brought it to the attention of the people by reading these out every day. This was what was wrong with the air quality in Dublin. And our plane trees were covered in soot and they sloughed off their bark. But lots of the other trees were covered in soot and didn't slough off their bark. I was working in Furze Firbaugh at the time, and we were doing tests on the lichens that were growing on the trees. Lichens are little tiny plant-like things that grow on trees and get all their nutrients from the air. And if the air is filthy and full of nitrous oxides and soot and stuff, they won't grow. And I had the children of Dublin in fifth year in secondary schools going around those trees and measuring it. And there were swathes of Dublin which had trees that had absolutely no lichens on it. So two things happened. It was 1989. I did a survey, produced all the results, and two things happened. Caused by me, I don't think. One of them was Furze Firbaugh, where I worked, was closed down. It was abolished at that point. And the second thing was that the Air Pollution Act came in. There was a ban on burning smoky coal in Dublin, and people had to convert to smokeless coal. They had to convert to natural gas. And by the year 2000, there were lichens on the trees all over Dublin. The air quality was much better. But the trees were the key, the trees themselves and what grew on them, really told the tale. The councils could have a monitor in Rathmines, or they could have one in Ballyfermot, but my trees grew everywhere, at least Dublin's trees grew everywhere, and we were able to, by looking at the amount of lichens on those trees, no lichens at all along the city centre, out to the North Strand, and interestingly in Dundrum and Rathmines and those swankier parts of Dublin, if you like, in a way, because there was so much of that soot emitted out of the chimneys. So Dublin is a much cleaner place now, so I'm sure your tree Terry, that you're sitting under like a philosopher, if you look at the leaves and look at the bark, they probably are not covered in the grimy substance that you might have seen if you'd been sitting there in the 1980s.
No, you're dead right, Aina, and I am sitting in here, and it's the last of the evening sun. And what I would really like to say to the grounds now are shut today because it's closed on a Sunday, but I've been allowed in today. But it's open during the week, so why don't people just come down here when they're out for a walk or out for a ramble? Come in, sit down, have your photo taken on the tree, because it is a real hidden gem, this tree. It's a real curiosity. It's just like the Blessington Street Basin, which is another hidden gem, but that's only about 200 metres up the road from here. So it's a fantastic tree, and it's just amazing just to look at it. I'll have a look at the photos. That's all I can say, Derek.
Terry, thank you very much indeed.
Terry,
yes,
I have to take exception to your remark about you calling the tree a carnivorous tree. I mean, it's eating an iron seat. An iron seat is not a lump of meat. Are you afraid that you, sitting on the iron seat, will be eaten by the tree if you sit there long enough? Is that what you're afraid of?
No, I think you've heard the term benchers, Aina, I'm sure. And benchers would be the kind of apprentice lawyers and that. I'm sure many of them, when they were studying out here, were gobbled up by this tree here, all right. So I'm not going to sit too long in it, just in case, because there's plenty of fat in me, I can tell you, Aina. It'd love me, all right.
Off you go, Terry. Thank you very much indeed. Actually, listening to Aina kind of made me feel like I was in an episode of Reeling in the Ears on radio.
Excuse me.
Yeah, no, you're excused. It's all right.
No,
it's nothing to do. It's just you told the story so well. Anyway, yesterday I found myself in Fairview Park for a little bit of a walk, a park that's open pretty much all the time now. There are no gates on it. And I made a very interesting observation. For me, anyway, I think you'll find it interesting too. Have a listen. Well, here I am in Fairview Park, and what a beautiful day it is. It's Saturday afternoon, about 1:30 p.m. or thereabouts. I'm just out for a little bit of a walk. I'm not alone. There are lots of walkers here, lots of joggers, lots of sporting activities. There's some guys over there practicing their kendo martial arts. There are basketball players, footballers, skateboarders, you name it. In fact, it's a real eye-opener, this park, I have to say. It's like being at the Olympics. I thought that was supposed to be happening in Japan. Anyway, that's all going on, but there's something else going on one of the empty playing fields here. There's a soccer pitch and there's nobody on it. All the others are taken up. And I am transfixed by what looks like the Red Arrows aerobatics display team, but it's in fact two swallows. And they're flying zoom so fast above the ground. It's extraordinary. Just put a mental picture in your mind of swallows feeding in the air. Now get down to grass level. Go all the way down where I am now. Almost smell the grass. Well, I can smell the grass. It's freshly cut here. And those birds are flying so close. I mean, they're just pretty much skimming the surface, and it's extraordinary how they're feeding at such a speed and how they can catch those insects. But they're going left, right, up, down, straight ahead, and then they seem to get to the end of the pitch and they go up in the air, they do a 360 degrees and they come back down again and do it all. It's extraordinary. Whoa! One of them just went past me there, but it is beautiful to see. Now, I've made a video, put it on the website, you can have a look, but don't blink, you're going to miss it, because they're travelling very fast indeed. Actually, you know what it reminds me of? Monty Python and the Holy Grail. Anybody see that movie? Now, fans of Monty Python, I wasn't a fan, but I saw the movie. There's a scene in it, and it's called the Bridge of Death scene. And you've got King Arthur and his Knights of the Round Table, who are off in search of the Holy Grail, and they have to cross this bridge called the Bridge of Death. And there's a keeper on the bridge, and in order to pass safely, they've got to answer questions, and if they get them correct they can pass, and if they don't, anyway, long story short, Lancelot goes first and he gets across the bridge safely, and they all think, oh, this is pretty easy, we'll follow suit. And then I think it's Sir Galahad and Robin, but they fall over because they get the questions wrong. And then it comes to King Arthur himself, and he's the smart bunny, and your man says to him, he comes out the little elfly, he said what's your name? And he says, King Arthur, King of the Britons. And he said, what's your quest? He said, I'm looking for the Holy Grail. And he said, what's the airspeed velocity of an unladen swallow? You know, those kind of random, out of the blue questions. And of course, King Arthur says, what do you mean? An African or a European swallow? So my question to Richard and Niall, being the birdie guys on this programme, is what is the average velocity airspeed of an unladen swallow? In fact, what is an unladen swallow? Now, you notice that my impression of King Arthur, he went from being an English gentleman to an Irish thug.
He was Cornish, he's somewhere in the between, probably.
He was Celtic, all right. Okay, so Richard Collins, can you answer that question, please?
Well, yes, I believe I can. It is taken to be around 50 to 60 kilometres per hour in level flight. Now, it is deceptive because the ability really comes from the tail. The swallow has this wonderful tail which enables it to twist and turn and target individual insects. And that's why it looks so very fast. If you take a swift, swift goes up to 112 kilometres an hour, per hour, roughly. It can reach 160, apparently. But it's a kind of a trawler. It scoops, it opens them out, then it heads through. But the swallow is different. He's able to target individual things. So it looks much faster than it is. If you were driving very fast in a confined space, you would seem to be doing a ferocious speed, when in fact, objectively, you're not doing all that much. But you're right, the swallow is a remarkable acrobat, the very best, I suppose, in many ways.
Yes, Richard, you're spot on there. It's the manoeuvrability of the swallow that's so impressive, the way it can turn and twist in the air. And Derek, when you were watching them there in the park, they would have been obviously catching insects that were rising up off the grass. They often do that in warm days. And they're so manoeuvrable that, you know, there's no risk of them hitting the ground at any stage. Like other birds wouldn't be anywhere near as manoeuvrable in the air. So they can zoom around, they can turn very, very quickly. The forked tail and the pointed wings help them to do that. So your analogy of the red arrows, it's a very appropriate one. That's really what they're like. They're like flying in display flights. It's really very impressive the way that they do it. But as you were saying, Richard, the swallow, as it goes, isn't a particularly fast bird. There's many species that fly much faster than that. Most duck species, for example, would go way faster than that. And of course, the swift, aptly named, goes a lot faster than the swallow. They do the migration faster as well. So it's the manoeuvrability that's really important there. Now, I've long been a Monty Python fan, and the thing that always bugged me a little bit about that scene in the film was for the question about whether it was a European or an African swallow. Because, of course, the swallows we have here are both European and African at the same time. Half of their life is here with us in Europe, the other half is in sub-Saharan Africa. So I don't think it's right to distinguish between a European or an African swallow. They're both at the same time. And of course there are many, many species of swallow in Africa as well. So the one that comes to us here, often called the barn swallow, that crosses the Sahara and comes to Europe. But there's many other species wandering all over Africa that never come anywhere near Europe.
There was an interesting project done by Lund University in Sweden recently. They published a paper this month, actually, on it, about swifts. And geolocators on swifts going to Africa and coming back, they found that they travel, on average, 570 kilometres per day over 9 days. And one swift covered 830 kilometres on average every day. The really interesting finding is that they come back from Africa about 20% quicker than they go down to Africa in
tailwind.
The autumn. Tailwind is everything, yes, yes. So swallows probably do a little less than that when their geolocators were on switch. They're fairly big birds. Swallows a bit small, I suppose, to have geolocators at that level. But I would think swallows don't quite match that, but they can't be far behind.
I was with Kendrew Calhoun some years ago, and they were putting little transmitters onto the backs of swifts in Northern Ireland. So they really are tiny little transmitters, so they could pretty much put them on any bird nowadays. But I was wondering about the wind. You could hear on my recording that it was quite windy yesterday, yeah. And yet it didn't seem to disturb the bird's flight at all.
No, they're very good at coping with that, because of course on their migration they cope with far worse weather than Ireland can throw at them. They go through heavy, heavy winds and storms, so they do very well. And of course, to them that would just be a fairly light breeze, actually stirring up the insects as well, which helps them. But that again, forked tail, their pointed wings help them cut through that air. In fact, helps with their aerodynamics and helps with their buoyancy. So that's very good too. You're asking about how a swallow might be laden. That was one of the questions.
Oh yes, so but it was unladen swallow.
Yes, yes, indeed. So I know that in the film, if I recall correctly, I think that the speculation was that one might be laden with coconuts because they're wondering how they get the coconut shells to make the plumping of the horses. Now, a swallow, no way a swallow could carry a coconut. A swallow only weighs about 18 to 20 grams. So it's very small. So I think that the only thing it could really be laden with would be maybe a lot of insects in its stomach. Mm. Those transmitters, they're not a low enough weight that it would actually be ethical to put them on a swallow yet, because the swallow weighs a lot less than a swift. So they're small enough to put on swifts without causing them any inconvenience.
Oh, Niall. But just to put it in context for our listeners, I held one of those transmitters in my hand, and if you got a little paper clip, it's about the same weight.
Yep.
It feels about the same.
So if you think
Are you telling me that's too heavy for a little swallow to carry on its back?
Well, if you think it weighs about, let's let's say a gram. That's what some of these transmitters weigh, and they're very expensive. It weighs about a gram. So if you have a bird that only weighs 18 to 20 grams, that's still a very significant percentage of its weight. That actually could have an effect on its survivability and also on its aerodynamics. So it's something that has to be weighed up. The technology gets better and better all the time, so I'm sure it's only a matter of time before that becomes commonplace. But it's a bit risky at the moment.
Richard?
Yes, it's a very interesting one, that. What you must consider when you look at swifts and swallows in the air, that the ground does not matter at all. The whole thing is relative to the air. And if the air is moving relative to the ground, that doesn't matter. The swallows and swifts are working, and the insects are moving with the air mass. So the ground, looking at it, basing everything on the speeds from the ground, is misleading, really. They don't worry about the ground. They live in the air. The air is their life.
Email mooney@rte.ie. Take a look at our website, rte.ie/mooney.
You can visit the website anytime you like, rte.ie/Mooney. Now, if you can cast your minds back to the 21st of May last, there was a wonderful picture in the Irish Times of Newgrange falconer Brian McCann and his golden eagle chick. This was the great news that for the first time in Ireland, a rare golden eagle had been born through artificial insemination. This, of course, relates to birds in captivity as opposed to those which were reintroduced into the wild here some 20 years ago. Brian McCann is the man who made it all happen. After many disappointments, the eagle has literally landed for Brian. And if you remember that photograph, I can tell you this chick has grown quite a lot since then. It now weighs 5 pounds, 5 ounces in old money. That's about 2.4 kilos today. Anyway, Brian's falconry is based in the Boyne Valley, from where he joins us now. Hello, Brian. Tell us how this came about, please.
Well, I've have a small falconry, so I have, and I take people out for little falconry lessons and stuff like that. I'm retired from the fire service, and this was my hobby all along, and it just developed into a little business. But I was always interested in nature and wildlife and stuff like that, so I always wanted to have birds of prey, and then it developed into wanting to have a golden eagle. So I ended up with a male golden eagle that I got in from Scotland, and I had him and I was flying him, and so that was great. But then a friend of mine told me that there was one for sale in Ireland, a female, and when I seen her, actually I thought she was absolutely gorgeous. So I decided that I went and seen her, and I decided to buy her, and that was it. Then actually what happened then was I ended up with two eagles that probably, and I didn't plan this, Derek. This was not planned to have chicks or do that, but I ended up with two golden eagles that possibly I might have been able to do AI with. So I learned the process of AI, so I did, with the male and obviously the female as well. So, and it took me 3 years to, you know, to be able to achieve it. So, and I ended up with a chick after that. So that was the first eagle ever bred in Ireland in captivity.
Presumably you had to do all of this under licence.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. Like, I mean, anybody that participates in falconry has to have a licence to do it. And you have to have a licence to have birds of prey, but you also have to have a licence, a separate licence to do falconry. And obviously you have to have CITES as well with all of these, so that they're bona fide captive bred birds. So, yeah, that's the CITES. And they're very, very strict, the Irish government, and worldwide CITES on all sorts of different animals and birds of prey.
Just to tell our listeners that CITES is the Convention for the International Trade of Endangered Species. So you must have a licence from them to export and import birds. And then you must have a licence from the National Parks and Wildlife Service to engage in the activities that Brian is talking about there. Correct, Brian?
That's correct, yeah. And it's very strict, like the department are very, very strict on all of that. So, and properly so, you know, that to make sure that there's no illegal, you know, movement of birds or trade of birds. And that's what I'd be always in favour of, you know, anybody that participates in falconry that should be up for all of that.
Brian, I wonder what it's like to own an eagle. Do you develop a friendship, a dependence, an interrelationship with the bird? How personal is that? If I was to go to Yule Falconry and walk in, would she treat me the same way as she treats you?
Absolutely not. She'd be gunning for you, so she would. If you come down our garden now, yeah, she'd be really gunning. They're very intelligent birds, and you do build a bond with them. And that bond is between you and the bird, and they don't seem to be able to change readily to another person. So it takes time to build that bond. If you were to take, say, one of my birds today, and that bird would take, it takes a while for that relationship to build the bond. And even like when you're breeding the eagles that I have, and the male is an imprinted bird, so he sees me as his partner, and then the female also, who is not an imprint but is semi-imprinted over the period of time that she's been with people, you know. So, and she's a really, really good bird. She has a, and it's down to the person that would have had her initially before me as well, all helps, because if you treat a golden eagle properly and it's brought up the right way, it's a, they're a lovely bird. But if you do something wrong on them, they realise that there's something wrong that's been done to them, and they don't forget easily, you know. So
Are you in permanent lockdown to your eagles? I mean, you can't head off to the west of Ireland for a holiday after a year locked up, because the poor old eagles are going to pine away. They're expecting you every minute with nice juicy meat for them or whatever. Or is there some way you can get around that?
Yeah, well, I mean, I do have a feeding hatch that, you know, the food can be put in and they will take it. But like I didn't have a holiday for 5 years until last year. Well, this just before the COVID came in. So it was lovely to get away over to Canary Islands, and it was really enjoyed me. But I hadn't been away for 5 years because looking after the birds. So that is a drawback, you know.
Well, now, if you brought the two together, the male and the female, they both regard themselves as married to you, and they will see each other as rivals and third parties. And will they fight with each other, or will they in any way accept each other?
They may accept each other, but it's a very strange thing. The aviary that the male is in is right opposite where the female is. And he actually watches her, and when she's going to lay eggs, he's more productive in giving up the goods, as we'll say, the semen. And that's when he actually looks for me to do that with him, you know. So I collect the semen off him, and we have a special way of doing that. Like, it's there's nothing that's ever forced in any way with male or female, and it's readily done. And that's the good part of the way it works with the two that I have.
Tell us about doing that. And you have to do the same then with the female, but it's not so difficult there.
The male sees me as his female, so he does. And there's nothing kind of done except that he fixates on my arm, and I have a little pad that that he presses down on, and the semen is collected in that. And it's very simple, and there's no catching up the bird in any way at all. The bird is free to come over and fly away from me, and that's the way it works.
He makes love to you then, does he, Brian?
You could say that, but he sees the female over there and in the other aviary, and I know that definitely does have a big effect on him. So that's why I would think that maybe if you put the two of them together, that they may be a pair, you know? So whether the female would accept him is another thing, you know? So it may work. She's quite a very docile. She's a lovely female, so she is, and she's... I can go in now to the aviary with her and pick up the chick, and even feed the chick, and feed her to feed the chick, and even feed the chick, you know. So that's very unusual, you know, to be able to do something like that with a golden eagle, you know.
But of course, in the wild, the male provisions the female when she's incubating and when the chicks are small and so forth. So you are the husband after all. So I suppose she regards you as doing the perfectly natural thing of providing food for her. Is that the model?
And as soon as she sees me, when I go down the garden every couple of hours, I have to go down with food, fresh food, and she starts chattering and she's looking for food to give to the chick.
Brian, lovely to speak with you. Thank you very much indeed.
Derek, can I say hello to my mum in Muirhall Nursing Home in Blackrock in Dundalk?
What's her name?
Vera McCann. She's 92 years old.
Well, happy birthday to Vera McCann, 92. Thank you, Brian. Bye.
Send your wildlife recordings, questions and observations on WhatsApp to 087 708 7031. Email mooney@rte.ie.
Well, as we mentioned at the top of the programme, tomorrow, the 21st of June, is the longest day of the year, the summer solstice, and we'll celebrate that tomorrow evening right here on RT Radio 1 with a specially lengthened edition of Mooney Goes Wild from 10 until 11.30pm. We'll have lots of Ireland's most favourite naturalists on board right throughout the country tomorrow evening, and we'll have two of Ireland's greatest traditional musicians, Paddy Glacken and Donal Lunny, who are here with us now to give us a sample of what lies ahead tomorrow evening. So let's go over to Studio 8 now and say hello to Donal Lunny and Paddy Glacken.
Thank you very much, Derek, and we're really looking forward to taking part in celebrating the summer solstice tomorrow night on RTE Radio 1. Donal.
Well, indeed, Derek, we have a rake of tunes for your listeners tomorrow night.
Lovely.
But to get you in the mood now, this is a tune written by the late, great Junior Crean called The Mist-Covered Mountain.
Evening for our special celebration of the summer solstice. Make a date in your diary, 10 to 11.30pm right here on RT Radio 1. In fact, we want to be hearing from you again tomorrow as we do this evening. So do join us tomorrow evening. Ken Whelan, our fishery scientist, has popped in. We're going to be talking to him in just a moment about the relationship between fish eyes and what they've been eating. But first, Ken, we were talking earlier about the velocity, the speed of an laden swallow.
Yeah.
Any idea what the fastest fish in the oceans is?
I knew you were going to stick me with this.
From memory,
I think it's probably the sailfish, and I think they do about 100 kilometers per hour, 60, 70 miles an hour.
Wow.
Fabulous creatures. Let me tell you the most extraordinary thing about sailfish, which people don't really appreciate.
Well, before you tell us that, will you describe what it looks like first?
Absolutely. So the sailfish is one of the billfish, so it has a great big pointed beak at the front, and it has a beautiful sail that goes almost the full length of the dorsal fin. And it's extraordinarily high when you lift up the fin. You know, you're looking at several feet high, the fin. But the most extraordinary thing about that fin is, and I was privileged many years ago to do some tagging in Africa, and we were bringing the fish into the side of the boat to put some little tags in their back. And I could not get over the sound of the fin in the wave. It's made of a material that must be very similar to canvas. And what I wasn't expecting was the flapping of the sail. It was the most extraordinary thing, and I'll never, ever forget it as long as I live. And it's not something that you ever hear mentioned.
Have you ever seen one, Niall?
I haven't. I'd love to. Very impressive fish, absolutely. But nope, I haven't been lucky enough.
And they can jump just so, so high. They are fantastic creatures. They really are. And the other thing is, when we were bringing them on board, the crew were so nervous of that bill because they had seen it do some serious damage to people that weren't careful. It's really, really, really
rough. And why were you tagging them?
Well, what was happening was we were actually sport fishing. But at that stage, which was about 15 years ago or more, the group that we were with were trying to promote a situation whereby none of the fish that were caught were actually harvested. So they started to tag the billfish. And in fact, a marlin that my brother caught and tagged ended up being caught again. And they got fantastic information about the migratory pattern of the fish. And there were certain areas along the African coast. We were in Kenya. And there were certain areas in Somalia and so on north of us where there was quite a big harvest and they were losing a lot of fish. But it was interesting. They did get some tags back. So it gave them a great idea as to how these species might be managed.
So the speed again, just to remind everybody, this is something that's going to come up on one of these table quizzes in some future day.
You can blame me if it's wrong.
Come on.
I think it's about 100 kilometres an hour. I think it's 60 to 70 miles an hour is what they were clocked at.
So the sailfish is the fastest fish in the ocean.
A sailfish is the fastest fish in the ocean, and I can be sacked if I'm wrong.
All right.
Take a look at our website, rte.ie/Mooney. Send your wildlife recordings, questions and observations on WhatsApp to 087-708-7031.
I think what we're going to have to do is make a special programme with all of your WhatsApp recordings, because we've received quite a few of them and we have a backlog of them, and we will get through them. But the programme, the nature of the programme, it's not even an hour long. Anyway, shut up, Derek. Ken Whelan is here, our fisheries expert, as I said. And Ken, I mentioned before the ad break that you know by looking into a fish eye what that fish has eaten. Come on, you're making it up.
Well, yes, the eyes definitely have it this evening. Let me explain to you what we're about. And this is all down to my very brilliant colleagues in the US and now in the UK as well. So I have talked on numerous occasions on the programme about fish scales and about fish ear stones and the clever things we could do in saying how the fish grew and the age of the fish. Then we went a step further and we start to take little samples out of these and we could look genetically at the fish. But now what they're doing is we have a situation with salmon where very large numbers die after spawning quite naturally. So colleagues of mine are actually collecting the bodies of these fish and collecting the eyes out of the bodies of these salmon. And using a very fine forceps, they're able to peel back the layers in the eye, just like a tiny, tiny onion. And each layer is telling them a story in terms of what the fish has been feeding on and where. And it's all down to the whole idea of what we call chemical isotopes. So the atoms that are in our body, whether it's nitrogen or carbon, come in different forms. And there are forms that we call isotopes. They're very stable. They're not the radioactive isotopes you hear about in terms of Chernobyl. They're really stable. But the pattern of isotopes that you find in particular food items is very steady. And they can actually tell then, hopefully, where the fish have been by way of analysing the actual eyes of the fish and seeing what has been laid down through their food. And they're beginning to actually build maps in terms of the actual areas in the ocean where the fish are feeding. All a bit loose at the moment, but every year that goes by, it's becoming more and more accurate. And I'm glad to say that now the Marine Institute in Ireland and many of my colleagues in the UK are working on a fairly major programme to see can we start using this technology as well.
And what's the purpose of using it? What will you find out and what will it tell you? How will you help the salmon?
Well, what we will find out is we've spoken on the programme on numerous occasions about the way climate change is directly impacting the migration and the feeding of these fish at sea. They live very, very high in the water. They live near the top of the ocean. They live within maybe 30 centimetres of the ocean as young fish. So everything that's happening by way of climate change is affecting these fish. And we think that it is changing currents and we think that it is changing the actual food that's available to them. So what we're hoping to be able to see are areas where there may be a change in terms of the food composition, because we have some idea as to what they were feeding on in the past. And if there's a change in diet, hopefully they'll be able to pick this up by looking at the layers in the eyes of fish. I know it sounds really space age and it sounds over the top, but I think it's a really exciting breakthrough.
Well, what do you expect salmon to be eating normally?
Well, it's interesting because people look on them as sort of majestic creatures that are going to eat very delicately. These creatures start off eating plankton in the ocean, but as quickly as they can, they become silver pike and they feed on fish. And predominantly, they're feeding on a fish called capelin up around, say, Greenland. They feed on squid. But these are big, big silver predators. So they're looking opportunistically for any fish that they can find in the surface layers of the ocean.
Aina.
Yeah, so these fish, Ken, that they're feeding the capelin and the squid, have they different isotopes per species? So you would have capelin isotope, which would be different to squid isotope. And, you know, will they then be in the layers in the eyes? It certainly gives a different reading to keeping your eyes peeled, that's for sure.
Well, trust you, Aina. Yes, no, that's exactly it. Also, obviously, in terms of the actual chemical composition of the bodies themselves, in terms of the elements that they're including in the body structure. So as well as what they're eating, also the other components that are helping to build up the body, they're hoping to be able to build maps. But really, it's open season at the moment. And you'll be aware that, quite recently, there was a huge interest in microchemistry. So in addition to the isotopes themselves, they can also look at the chemicals that are in the ocean that are much more prevalent in the ocean than freshwater. And something we looked at relatively recently was the element strontium. So if you get a lot of strontium in a scale, you can be fairly sure that fish has spent some time in the estuary or the ocean. So it's fantastic. It's real detective work that my colleagues are about at the moment.
And will they change fish? I mean, they're eating capelin, but I mean, if climate change causes the capelin not to be in the water, then will they change to a different species completely?
Well, it's not just that, because at times we know it can be even more dramatic in the sense that because of the change in currents, when the fish go out at a relatively small size, they may end up accidentally in the wrong location. So if they end up in the wrong location, they may actually start absorbing in chemicals into their eyes from the natural food that they're finding, which is quite different to the food that they might have been feeding on in the 20s, 30s, 40s and so on. So you can see some real changes as a result of these chemical analyses.
Ken, is there a hierarchy of food for salmon? In our case, human case, some parts of the world have very great food resources, very good food. In other parts of the world, it's much more subsistence and so forth. Is it like that in the world of salmon? Can you say that they are in leaner times now than they were long ago?
Yeah, well, I think, indirectly, I think that's probably true in that when you think of the very small fish that are going out, no more than maybe 12 or 15 centimetres, they're carried along by these massive great currents. They're very active within the currents. So they don't really have a lot of choice in terms of where they initially end up. And it's around 750 grams to a kilo that they become masters of the ocean. And then they can forage and move around at will. But until that, they're fairly constrained. And that could be the key, because in that area where they're constrained, if we can actually find a consistent pattern in years when their migration is actually very accurate and where the currents are moving as they have in the past, then we can get a baseline. And if we see a deviation from that, and suddenly it seems as if they're feeding off the north coast of Iceland, we know that the currents have gone wrong. And that's the hope. This is all very much speculation at the moment, but isn't it fun to speculate?
It certainly is, Ken. Thank you very much indeed for coming in. You can learn more about it by visiting the website anytime you like, rte.ie/Mooney. Very quickly, Niall, a text message has come in. Can buzzards kill baby lambs? Now, I think I told you I was travelling up Northern Ireland a couple of weeks ago, and there were lots of buzzards in the sky.
Yes, I saw lots out today. A nice warm day, so the buzzards are using the thermals, the rising warm air to fly. So just to be absolutely categoric about this, buzzards cannot and will not kill baby lambs. They will sometimes feed on dead lambs or on stillborn lambs, but they're no threat whatsoever to livestock. We're absolutely certain about that. they're in fact a real benefit because they kill rats and rabbits and young crows as well. So they're farmer's friend, we always call them.
Niall, thank you very much indeed. Thanks to Annie Nilana, to Dr. Richard Collins and Dr. Ken Whelan. Our broadcast coordinator is Jarlath Holland. Our researcher is John Bell O'Reilly. And on sound today, we had Mark McGrath. Don't forget, tomorrow night, Mooney Goes Wild special, the summer solstice, the longest day of the year from 10 to 11.30. Till then, bye-bye!
Take a look at our website, rte.ie/Mooney. Mooney Goes Wild was presented and produced by Derek Mooney.